And many people who, have that kind of abusive personality, they can pick up on those insecurities, and they try to show themselves as, I'm someone you can come to, I understand you. They might meet another teen who also comes from a broken home or a divorced home. So now they're deeply connecting on that shared struggle, and it feels like this person is a dream come true. And so for many teens, they kind of fall head over heels and think this person's amazing. And then suddenly, a few months later, they might start to change, be a little bit more controlling and possessive and jealous. And there's such a disconnect from between who you met that, many teens stick it out. They stay. They want to wait for that person they fell in love with to come back to them. So I think you're right. It's definitely a vulnerable time. And if somebody shows you interest and desire in who you are and makes you feel good for a minute, you will very quickly fall into a relationship with that person.
For most of us, belonging to a stepfamily was never part of the plan. We never planned to get divorced, never planned to fall in love with somebody who already had kids and an ex-spouse who's not going anywhere. But here we are, trying our best to solve the blended family puzzle. I'm Brittany Lynch, and for the last 15 years, I've been working with the human body, mind, and spirit. As a certified stepfamily counselor, mental health nurse, and having been a stepmom myself for the last decade, I've learned that happy stepfamilies are built by healthy people. Welcome to the Whole Stepfamily Podcast, where you will learn how to create peaceful, loving, authentic stepfamily relationships that allow you to be who you really are so you can love the life you live and the people you live it with.
As we wait on the timing, together we find it. There's more than one way to go home.
Hello and welcome to the Whole Step Family Podcast. I am your host, Brittany Lynch, with a very special, exciting guest for every parent who has a teen or will someday, one day, have a teen. Ashley Bendixson is a national speaker and top youth speaker as a subject matter expert in teen dating violence, youth mental health, domestic and sexual violence. Year-round, she travels the U.S. speaking to students, parents, educators, and youth-serving adults. She's also the co-owner of Island Youth Coaching, which offers one-on-one life coaching for teens, as well as consulting for youth-serving organizations. Additionally, Ashley is an award-winning activist, having led countless social change and policy initiatives. This includes founding the Blue Hearts Project, a global storytelling platform for survivors. Ashley, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be here today.
Oh, yeah, we're very excited to be talking with you. Before I pressed record, we were just noting how many members in our community right now in our group coaching program have adolescents, teens, tweens, and one of the concerns that has been coming up more recently has been this question of what happens when our kids start dating. And what happens when our kids start to become involved in relationships that are inevitably likely going to progress to having some physical intimacy component to them, as relationships tend to do when we get older. And I mean, this is absolutely not my forte. And I feel like this is a conversation we don't hear a lot about, even though there's so many teenagers and so many parents of teenagers. So I am really excited to hear how we can support our kids and support ourselves as parents of these kids trying to navigate these really kind of complex, special gloved sorts of conversations. So thank you again for being here. I won't talk the whole entire time because I want to hear what you have to say. Why don't you just back up and kind of let me know what on earth was it that brought you into this work in the first place?
Yeah, so this issue is very close to home. And like many people pursuing, mission-driven work, it really stems from my own experiences. I was a teenager who, unfortunately, with my very first relationship, found myself as a victim of abuse. And, I was young. I was new to dating, new to this whole world of relationships, had never talked to my parents about healthy relationships. And unfortunately, this abusive relationship was something I kept a secret. And it really impacted me, my mental health, my grades, my goals in life. And unfortunately, that was the beginning of a 6-year cycle of just kind of on again, off again, abusive relationships. It was really all I knew. And when I finally, you know, to make a long story short, escaped that cycle of my life and learned and healed, I really felt called to having these conversations. I always wondered, what if I had heard a story like mine? What if I had learned about this stuff? And I began telling my story just kind of to give back and help others. And before I knew it, here I am 16, 17 years later, still speaking. And it kind of just changed the trajectory of my life. I went back to school. I studied the justice system, went into victim services, prevention education. And now this is what I do full time. As most people heard in my bio, the bulk of my work is speaking at that middle school and high school age, both to the students and the youth, as well as the adults in their lives, such as parents and even teachers, about what they can do. So I feel very blessed every day. It came from a dark place, but I feel very grateful that I've been able to find myself on the other side of it to now really be a guide for other people.
Yeah, and thankfully, you were one of those people who has been able to take your lemons and turn them into lemonade and turn this into initiative to really support healthy relationships. You know, as you're speaking, I couldn't help but go back in my mind to when I began dating in middle school. And I never, you know, I've done so much work on myself where I've looked at the patterns of potential abuse dynamics in my past relationships, but I've never gone before adulthood for whatever reason until this moment. I've only reflected on those adult relationships, but as you have just revealed to us, these patterns of how we show up in relationship and what kind of behaviors we tolerate and what kind of behaviors we engage in ourselves begin all the way back in adolescence.
Absolutely.
So I guess I have to lead with the question of, you know, what age do you start to see romantic relationships beginning to form?
Yeah, I think this is challenging to label only because young people use the term dating in many ways. You know, to one child, it might be like we have a phone relationship and we text a lot. It could be someone I met online that I have a crush on, or it could be a real life relationship. But I think just from my own work, you know, as early as fourth and fifth grade, there are students that self-identify as having been, quote unquote, in a relationship. And what's even scarier is sometimes I'm, you know, delivering some pretty, you know, direct ideas to them about how a partner can act. And many of them come up and say they've experienced it. So, you know, I think this starts late elementary school. I think as far as parents goes, you know, the conversations can start even earlier. Really, it's a conversation around, you know, talking to your kids about what a healthy relationship looks like. And that can start very young by turning relationship into friendship. You know, it's not always just an intimate partner, but if we can begin to have these conversations early about, you know, what's a healthy friend, what's a healthy peer, what behaviors are not okay, hopefully they apply those to the dating relationships later. But yeah, really when we're talking about my expertise, which is kind of the warning signs, the things that parents should be concerned about, once they're in kind of middle school to high school, these types of things are sadly very common.
Would you mind letting us know kinds of like a handful of green flags, shall we call them, and a handful of red flags that we as parents can kind of be on the lookout for when our kids start to venture into, shall we call it romantic relationship development, physical intimacy development, emotional intimacy development?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, when it comes to green flags, I think most of us can list the qualities of a healthy relationship, but there's often a big disconnect between knowing what that is and that being the reality of our partnerships in life. You know, I think to keep it really simple, I share this with students, and I think the same is true for adults. The two big questions to ask that are major green flags are, do I feel safe, and do I feel supported? And, you know, this feeling of being safe means not just physically safe, but emotionally safe, safe enough to be vulnerable, to express your needs, to communicate when something bad has happened, to work together. And then, you know, supportive doesn't mean just, you know, emotionally supported, but, you know, supported to be who you are, to have a unique sense of identity, to have your own hobbies and interests, because a healthy and loving partner will want you to grow and succeed and thrive. Whereas on the other side of that, many partners do not exhibit those qualities. So, you know, conversations are not met with respect. You know, there's arguments, there's a lot of blame shifting, there's name calling, there's criticism. Many teens who are in abusive relationships, their partner doesn't want them to have their own identity. They might try to influence who that person spends time with, try to control who they're friends with, what they wear, what extracurriculars they can join at school. You know, they don't try to encourage that person to pursue their interests. Rather, it's the opposite. They try to just center that person's life solely around them. So, you know, some red flags are really just looking at, you know, does it seem like my child's relationship is healthy? Are they supported? Are they able to have a sense of agency and autonomy? Do they have boundaries in place that are being respected? And if not, you know, I always say the biggest red flag is just kind of having a hunch that something is off, and just checking in, because it's complex. You know, there could be millions of red flags we could talk about, but, you know, those are kind of the big ones.
I can't help but like think about the way that, kids who come from divorced homes or homes where the parents have separated may be at kind of a higher risk for getting into relationships where these red flags might be a little bit more present due to, you know, all kinds of reasons that we see influencing parenting in blended families, right? Like when parents go out on their own and start to raise their kids on their own, all of these dynamics shift. And where we used to maybe have a two-parent home where there was two sets of eyes on the kids and that stability and that consistency, after divorce or after separation, you know, when the kids are bouncing back and forth, there's one parent is responsible for now all of the household, everything. So that parent has twice as much really responsibility as they used to have when their marriage was still intact or their relationship was still intact. And trying to support themselves emotionally through this adjustment period and living on their own, and now trying to support their kids emotionally who are going through this experience. And we know from the research that kids who come from homes where there is a co-parenting dynamic and they go back and forth have a significant impact on their self-esteem and a significant impact on their identity development, because after their home shifts, they're not really sure who they are anymore. And so when we add that on top of what I assume to be already kind of a developmental task of teenagehood, which is figuring out what your identity is, I can't help but wonder if there's more of a vulnerability for kids who come from blended families and separated homes and single parent homes, for all of this multitude of reasons that we just listed. So I guess if I have a question that is going to come from this, it is this something that you can attest to in what you observe in your work, either, I guess, theoretically or in real life?
Yeah, I think that's a really good observation on so many levels. I think, like you mentioned about just the role of the parent, when you're stressed out, everything just feels like another to-do, even if that's something as caring and compassionate as talking to your child about their social life, but it's just another thing on your plate. Sometimes these things can fall through the cracks. And when there's not another partner in the home to kind of approach these conversations with you, sometimes it's just the last thing on your list. So yes, some of these things will get overlooked. I do think that, you know, youth who struggle with their identity, their self-esteem, are often more vulnerable. And when it comes to abusive dating relationships, one thing that a lot of people don't realize is that the beginning is incredibly perceptibly healthy. You know, the relationship starts off on a high. You know, there's a term for it called love bombing. And so essentially you meet someone and they feel too good to be true. You know, if you're seeking a person of refuge, someone who makes you feel safe, seen, respected, and understood, when maybe you feel that's being neglected somewhere else in your life, you're much more likely to fall into that person's arms. And many people who, you know, have that kind of abusive personality, they can pick up on those insecurities, and they try to show themselves as, you know, I'm someone you can come to, I understand you. They might meet another teen who also comes from a broken home or a divorced home. So now they're deeply connecting on that shared struggle. And it feels like this person is a dream come true. And so for many teens, they kind of fall head over heels and think this person's amazing. And then suddenly a few months later, they might start to change, be a little bit more controlling and possessive and jealous. And there's such a disconnect from between who you met that, you know, many teens stick it out. They stay. They want to wait for that person they fell in love with to come back to them. So I think you're right. It's definitely a vulnerable time. And if somebody shows you interest and desire in who you are and makes you feel good for a minute, you will very quickly fall into a relationship with that person.
I often think that when we have conversations about abusive relationships, we tend to look at that from the perspective of if you are the person being abused in the relationship. I'm curious about what you have to say for parents of children who may be the abuser in that dynamic.
Yeah, this is something I love to discuss. And I bring this up in my talks in schools. You know, I'll say, if you think you might be abusive at times, that's okay. When you're a teenager, you're learning emotional management, emotional regulation. And I always give the example that every single one of us, when we really like someone, is afraid they're going to cheat. We might feel a little bit insecure. We might feel jealous. But some of us will just understand that that's an emotion and we work through it. And other people will then turn to a form of control, right? So, you know, an abusive partner might feel jealous and worried and tell their partner, okay, well, give me all your social media passwords so I can see you have nothing to hide, right? So that's like a controlling choice. So I think part of this is just recognizing that this is a developmental skill. And if someone feels like they might be abusive, or if a parent sees these behaviors, it's really just about emotional management. So, you know, finding a good therapist or somebody who can help that child really understand the emotions they're feeling and choose healthier choices, that's a huge first step. You know, unfortunately, dating violence, dating abuse, domestic violence, these are learned behaviors. So at some point in time, they learned these tactics and strategies to get their way, to feel in control. And unless you work to unlearn those things, they become embedded in who you are. So it's important not just for that child's current relationship, but also their life of, you know, mental well-being and success, because harboring those types of feelings and responses don't support a successful, happy, healthy life.
You've used the word controlling now a couple of times. So I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind offering us maybe a definition or an understanding of what is it that you mean by controlling. I assume and I think that this is a word that not a lot of people would identify, even if they were exhibiting behaviors that would be kind of from the fly on the wall perspective considered to be controlling. Nobody wants to say, yes, I'm controlling. Nobody wants to say that or maybe admit that to themselves. What is your definition of controlling as it applies to dating and violence in relationships?
Yeah, I think often we're mislabeling a lot of the things that we see. Most people call what are abusive relationships toxic, you know, oh, they were a toxic partner, this is a toxic relationship. But often it's the, you know, the markers of abuse. And so at the heart of abuse is this need by one partner to have power and control. And that's really important to understand. It's not a couple that, you know, constantly argues and bickers. It's one partner that's kind of always instigating the issues and trying to establish that sense of control. And, you know, control isn't always looking at someone and saying, you're not allowed to hang out with your best friend today, they can be really subtle about it. So, you know, when it comes to teens, you know, how they might control is they'll try to influence who your friends are, where you go, who you're out with. They might ask for proof. So if I say I'm going out with my best friend, Melissa, my partner might be texting me nonstop and saying, send me a picture, FaceTime me so I can see where you are. A lot of teens will also try to influence their partner's decisions. So, you know, basically, if you're struggling with jealousy, you know, it's this feeling that something is going to take your partner away from you. That could be another person or it could be an extracurricular. So maybe a controlling partner says, well, really, you're going to sign up for field hockey? I mean, you're already so busy and you hardly have time for me. You know, do you not care about spending time with me? So it's like this very subtle, constant, pervasive, like pressure to make sure that my partner's not upset. And without really knowing it, many teens suddenly realize, or after the fact realize, that most of their life was controlled by their partner's moods, making sure they wouldn't get upset. So control happens in many ways. And I think, you know, we mentioned this earlier, technology is a big piece of this too. So a lot of teens right now who are new couples, it's almost become the default to share your locations. And the mentality behind it is, well, if you have nothing to hide, why wouldn't you? So by default, they share their locations at all times. Other abusive partners who want to establish that control might demand that their partner shares their phone passwords, their social media passwords. They might say, show me your DMs so I know that you're not hiding anything. And some teens I've even heard, this is like an extreme, but I learn new things every day in schools. They actually will walk around the hallways on 24/7 FaceTime or phone calls with their partner. So these kids are walking around with their earbuds in. You think, oh, they must be listening to music, but it's actually just them being hooked into their abusive partner nonstop. And you hear lots of stories of, you know, a teen makes plans with their friends and suddenly their partner shows up at the restaurant, shows up at the movie theater. So it's just like I said, one day you wake up and you realize every choice I make has been wrapped around, you know, my partner's needs and interests over mine. So it's complex, but, you know, it's all these day-to-day things that to many teens that stuff is normal. Yeah, everybody shares the locations. Yeah, everybody sends a selfie once they get to their, you know, friend hangout. This is just normal to them. And we need to remind them that, you know, independence, agency, autonomy, boundaries are at the heart of healthy relationships. Otherwise, it impacts our mental health and our identity, as you mentioned earlier.
Wow. First of all, wow. I had no
long answer.
No, I just had no, I had no concept of how much contact is like considered to be kind of normal in the teen dating world, like to be always in contact. How would one, you know, like I, as a girl, you know, like as a girl, I think back to me as a teenager. And if I like really liked somebody, I would almost think it was like endearing that they wanted to be in contact with me all the time. Like I would almost take it as a measure of specialness or a measure of how much they cared about me. And I wonder if that might create some resistance to having healthy boundaries as a teen, as an adult even, when you're getting this really big reward of feeling like this person really loves and cares about you. And the reality is maybe they do to some degree really love and care about you and are really interested in you as a person. So how do we differentiate, you know, between what is endearing and cute and I don't know, appropriate, we'll call it, and what would be kind of crossing that line to be considered abusive or controlling or not healthy, not appropriate?
Yeah, I think with every couple, you can mutually agree upon being connected all the time and it can be totally healthy. And totally what you said, you know, when someone wants to spend every waking second with you, it feels good, right? It feels good to be wanted, desired, missed the second you leave their house. I think the differentiator is when you try to break the status quo, when you try to make a plan with your best friend, say you have a family thing on the weekend and suddenly it turns into an argument, a conflict, that's when we need to start to pay attention. And, you know, maybe the first time you talk about it and you realize that they really just missed you and wanted to see you. But if this becomes a pattern where every time you have something that doesn't involve them, it turns into an argument, that's kind of when we, you know, kind of that red flag goes up. You know, if you set a boundary and say, I'm going to be at my family's house for the next 3 hours and I won't be able to answer my phone and they're blowing your phone up. You know, this is when we start to realize, okay, there's something wrong, especially when you start to clock yourself from even making plans. Like you're already anticipating that if I try to make plans with my bestie this weekend, my partner might get upset. That's when it starts to cross that line into control. So sometimes these things just take time to look at. But yeah, once there's that fear, that walking on eggshells, and it also, I think we can look at the arguments too. So, you know, maybe your partner gets upset because you made plans that don't involve them. You know, how they handle their upset matters too. They might begin to shift the blame on you and say things like, well, you told me we were hanging out today. And you might have no idea what they're talking about, right? They're starting to play these mind games. Well, you know, if you cared about me, you'd want to see me today. You know how tough of a day I had. You know I'm at, you know, mom's today and I hate being at my mom's house. So they start to like play these mind games and guilt trip you, and it's almost like manipulative. And so that's what we need to pay attention to as well, because in healthy relationships, you can talk about things, express your feelings, but if one person's trying to guilt you into seeing them, that's a red flag as well. Mm-hmm.
I want to kind of circle this back to how you had begun to talk about technology. Now, obviously, one of the developmental tasks of teenage development is that they start to establish some independence from their parents, which is often the parent's cry of, you know, how do I continue to parent this person when they're not around as much, or they don't want anything to do with me, or they don't listen to me, or they don't come home, or they're always in their room on their phone. And I know that many of our clients in our programs have concerns about the amount of access adolescents have to their phones and their devices and their technology. And some of that is unmonitored use in their own home. Some of it is unmonitored use in their co-parents' home, which they have no control over. So this feels like a big confounding sort of problem to lump on top of something that's already feeling a little bit vulnerable of, you know, hopefully teens are being set up to succeed and set the patterns to develop healthy relationships into adulthood. But how does this complexity of developing your autonomy as a human, which is a natural, normal developmental task of teenagehood, and needing time away from your parents and needing the ability to make your own decisions and see how that ends up playing out to develop your autonomy and identity, with this parent concern of how do we monitor and how do we track and how do we control the amount of time that they're on their phones? Yeah, I feel like you know what I'm trying to ask, even though I don't have the words for it.
Yeah, I mean, I wish there was an easy answer to a question that's hard to even ask. It's tough. I mean, you know, we come from a different generation where we understand boundaries with technology and having limits and, you know, taking breaks, whereas young people don't. They, you know, their social lives online are just as real to them as their social lives in the real world. So I think it's tough. You know, I'm not an expert on, like, you know, parenting and technology, but I do believe that parents have a right to occasionally check in on their child. You know, there's still the parent-child dynamic, whether that kid's 17, 18 or not. You know, I think I always recommend you know, have access to your kids' phones, but don't check it every week. Don't check it every month. But just let them know, listen, I respect your privacy. You are growing adults. You know, I will never snoop. But every once in a while, as the parent, out of safety for your concern, I might just, you know, pop in and make sure there's nothing on your browser history that's concerning. Make sure there's nothing else that just pops out. But I'm never going to read all your messages and snoop. And I think that gives parents the right to, you know, if they do have some concerns and your child's not opening up, just do a safety check. I mean, dating violence aside, there are so many harms online right now, especially with like exploitation and child sexual abuse. There's just a lot of risks, even on things like TikTok and Instagram. So I think parents need to be very upfront with their kids and say, listen, there's a lot of risks out there. It's only my concern for your safety. I trust you. And really having conversations around, you know, if you ever see something that's concerning, you can tell me about it, no matter how embarrassing or bad it was that you came across on a YouTube video or on a site. And I think the other thing too is, you know, hopefully parents are building rapport in those teen years and really cultivating those relationships, because when it comes to issues like relationships and dating and even physical intimacy, what they're not learning from you, they're learning from Google. They're asking questions in the search bar and getting bogus answers on forums and Reddit, and it's really problematic advice sometimes. Or with intimacy, they're going on porn sites. So I think, you know, these are tough conversations to have, but, you know, I think just talking to your kids, you know, in a very direct way is the best approach. A lot of parents think, oh, this is cringe. My kids don't want me to talk to them about this stuff. But a lot of teens are craving the chance to talk about these things. So sometimes the parent can really open the door on that. So, you know, multifaceted answer to that question. But, you know, I think it's okay to check in. You're still the parent and they're still a child and they're still developing. And it's just finding that balance between giving them that independence, but also still protecting their safety.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any advice or tips or processes that parents might be able to follow when it comes to setting the tone for having one of these conversations about checking in? Like, what kinds of things are we going to want to say? How do we establish, how do we open the door to have that conversation? And then what do we say when we get into that conversation?
I think that having conversations around healthy versus unhealthy relationships can happen really effortlessly on a pretty regular basis. So, you know, you might be watching a TV show together or a movie or hear a song lyric and it just kind of sparks some conversation or some dialogue. You know, do you think that was normal, what we just saw on the reality TV show? Is that a healthy way to express love? You know, I think these are very casual conversations that can be fun. Another thing parents can do is don't ask your teen about their relationships, but ask them about the relationships they see at school and among their peers. So you might say, you know, are kids your age dating? Like, what do you think about that? What do you see? Really take that like third party approach so it's not like a awkward conversation for them. And then I think if parents actually have valid concerns, they've noticed something, being direct is really important. So I always say approach your teen and validate why you're checking in. So it might be, hey, Ashley, is everything okay? I noticed that you used to hang out with Melissa every Thursday, but you haven't done that in 2 months. You know, is everything all right? Is it because of the relationship? Like, validate it, give it a reason. Otherwise, most teens just feel attacked and my parents are just being weird and checking in. But if you can point something out, it can also be really helpful for them to self-reflect on maybe how they've changed. And then you just keep reaffirming, I'm here if you ever need to talk. You know, say that constantly, daily, weekly. You know, hopefully the more you do this, they will come to you if there's ever an issue. And, you know, I think just from a general, like, parent piece of advice, I always say when your kids come to you to talk about something, talk about it longer than you even have to. If they ask you about something silly and trivial, keep talking about it. Be curious. Ask them questions. Why do you ask? Tell me more. Help me understand. Because if you build that type of relationship, down the road when the big thing happens, they'll know that that's your style and your approach, and they're not going to be judged because you've already done it a million times over. So it's really just building a relationship with your child so that they open up.
I think that's a really, really important thing to like maybe pause on for a second. That this trust that develops in relationships between us and our kids develops over a very, very long period of time. And so if we are in the habit of maybe being more firm disciplinarians with our kids, we kind of put ourselves at risk of closing that door for them to want to tell us anything, because when they tell us what's happening, they're afraid that they'll get punished. They're afraid that they'll get their phones taken away. They're afraid that they'll be grounded. They'll whatever that looks like. So what I'm hearing is how important it is to even start way before teenagehood, way before adolescence begins, to create this atmosphere between you and your kids where they can actually tell you anything without having to worry about getting in trouble, because keeping that door open, keeping that line of communication open is what is going to end up keeping them safe as they turn into adults.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's something I really have reflected on in my own story, and it's so silly and minor, but really in second grade, and my parents were they were good parents. But second grade, I remember like feeling different and thinking for the first time, am I ugly? And I remember distinctly going home and asking my mom, "Mom, am I ugly?" And she gave me pretty typical parenting advice. She said, "Oh, Ashley, what are you talking about? No, you're beautiful. Why would you think that?" And I just kind of shrugged it off, and it was the end of the story. And then, years later, when I was bullied, I tried to bring it up, and she said, "Ashley, just ignore them, and eventually they'll stop." And it was okay advice, but there was no conversation. There was no like, let's talk about it. Let's learn more than we have to. So when the big things came up, one, I didn't feel like the advice would be helpful. And two, I just had never talked to my parents in depth about anything. It was always very surface level. So to suddenly bring up, something uncomfortable that happened on this date that I went on that I didn't tell them about and I lied behind their backs, it was just a no because I was afraid I would get in trouble. That was just the culture in my home. Like somehow I would have been at fault. So I've always thought, what if, I just had deeper conversations with my parents? What if in second grade that would have been more of a conversation? Could that have changed future ones? And the more I talk to parents, I just feel like this is such a common theme that keeps coming up is like cultivate the little conversations and then the big ones will come to you.
Yeah, I love that. That's great. What kinds of things do you think that parents most need to be kind of aware of as is happening in pop culture right now? As like, what are the trends? What are the trends in teen dating that parents should like be aware of, be on the watch for, other than what we've already talked about for kind of the standard red and green, not red, red, not red and not red flags? What else is going on in the teen dating world?
Yeah, I think we've touched upon a few of the big ones, especially the technological based control, right? Using phones to be controlling, using social media to control. I think probably what's most important for parents to understand is that when we're talking about something like dating abuse, the most common form of abuse is the verbal, emotional, psychological. So a lot of people, misinterpret that word as meaning physical harm. But really it's all the mental stuff. So to kind of just summarize like the four big ways that occurs, the first really big one is isolation. So a partner trying to remove the person they're dating from the things we discussed, family, friends, extracurriculars, belittling and putting down their interests to kind of just isolate that person totally to them. So that's kind of the first thing. And parents might notice this, like we discussed, suddenly your child isn't seeing their friends as much as they used to, or it almost seems like they have to decline offers from their friends. So isolation's the first one. The second one is control, which we've discussed has many different, faces and can occur in many different ways. The third is manipulation. And that's, you know, looking at the nature of their arguments, their conversations. Is your child's partner constantly making them feel guilty, making them feel bad, putting them down, using words as weapons, even doing little things like verbally insulting them and then playing it off like it's just a joke? You know, my partner in high school used to make comments about my looks in the cafeteria or share little personal details. And when I would get upset, he would say, "Lighten up. It's just a joke." So now you're just feeling really insecure and weird and doubting yourself. So manipulation happens in many ways. And then I think the fourth one that we haven't really talked that much about yet is that in these abusive relationships, the experience tends to go from one extreme to the next. So, you know, extreme mood swings, these very hostile threats. You know, one day the relationship can be on a cloud, you know, it's honeymoon phase all day. And then out of nowhere, the partner gets upset. They're making an accusation of cheating. They slam a door. They start driving erratically with your child in the car. And this can, like I said, happen out of nowhere. And usually during these extreme arguments, they're not just arguments, they're very volatile, where a partner might be screaming and shouting and punching walls or threatening to post private information, threatening to post, you know, a photo of you online, spread a rumor on social media, or even threatening to break your things, hurt you, or in many cases, hurt themselves. A lot of teens do try to leave these abusive relationships, but usually the abusive partner will pull out this card just as you're about to walk away and say, "If you walk away right now, I'll hurt myself, I'll kill myself, I can't live without you." And all of this stuff is so complex for anyone, but if you're a teenager, it is so hard to know what to do in those moments. And then suddenly following that, they're apologizing, they're promising this will never happen again, you have a good day, the person you met is back, but this cycle, those behaviors just keep happening in a loop and in a pattern. So, you know, often we're thinking, okay, I would know if my child has a bruise on their arm, but it's really paying attention to how your child might have changed, because that's the dynamic that they're living and in many cases hiding. You know, most teens don't ask for help. Only 33% statistically ever tell anybody. And usually they're only telling their best friend and they're, you know, begging them not to tell their parents. So kids are dealing with this and hiding it extremely well. So I think that's what parents need to understand about this issue. It's not physical and sexual violence all the time. It's all those mind games. And that's really damaging on your child's identity and self-esteem.
And I would anticipate additionally probably more longer term, as things start to develop, I would imagine that there's a significant impact that would have on that teen's mental health. So for parents who are, you know, maybe not super close with their kids or don't have a lot of monitoring on technology for whatever kinds of reasons they might not. If we look at our kids' mental health, what is considered like typical teenage moodiness and typical teenage mood swings? And when should we be maybe like raising an eyebrow and getting a little bit more curious about like mental health decline and wanting to get curious about maybe what's going on? Not necessarily just jumping to the conclusion that they're in an abusive relationship, but maybe starting to ask some questions or get closer.
Yeah, I think as long as parents are observant and present enough, they do notice changes in their child, whether that's sudden irritability, moodiness, they're, you know, hiding in their room more often. And I think that no matter what the cause of that is, it's always important to check in and have conversations. Because again, this is about talking about all things. But I think, you know, some key things parents can look out for is sudden changes in mood and attitude on a pretty persistent basis, where they're always picking fights, they're more irritable, they want to be in their room more, and maybe this is unlike your child. Typically, they're more bubbly and outgoing. You might pay attention to their appearance changes. You know, many teens who are in abusive relationships suddenly have to dress down because their partner's uncomfortable with how they look. Maybe they no longer do their hair and makeup. Maybe they're Or maybe their partner is saying that they need to get in shape, and suddenly they're, you know, crazy about going to the gym, and their, you know, kind of their eating habits have changed, or they're taking their dinner into their room every night. So, you know, those physical and hygiene changes. Academic changes are a big one. So suddenly your child went from having A's and B's to now C's and D's. Something might have happened. And as you mentioned, you know, an abusive relationship impacts your mental health. And when you can't mentally focus, you can't focus on things like school and grades. So often there's a correlation with academic challenges. And then I think the last one is really paying attention to changes in their social and relationship life, seeing that they don't see their friends anymore. Maybe there's other issues at school. Maybe there's some rumors and drama and bullying that's happening. All of these often stem from interpersonal issues. So I think, you know, the greatest red flag, like I said up front, is really that intuitive feeling that you have. It's just important to always check in. My parents, well-intentioned, you know, thought that I was being a disappointing child. Suddenly their good girl was, you know, sneaking out of the house and calling them names and swearing and being moody. And they just thought, you know, I was a problem child. Had they only just said, what's going on? Maybe I would have broke down in tears and just spilled it all out to them. But, you know, even that created more of a rift because I thought they don't get me. They don't even see that I'm struggling. And that's why I'm doing these things. So always pay attention to your gut and always just default to checking in.
That's so good that, you know, that created even more of a rift, that even though there were all of these acting out behaviors, there was still not an invitation to go in there with you. And I think, you know, for me, what's coming up is I would imagine that one of my pieces of resistance to wanting to go into that conversation with a teen would be my sense of being unprepared to handle what was coming. So if we are going to be having these, when, hopefully, this is not a when, not an if, but a when we begin to open these doors up and have these conversations with our teens, if it does come out that they are in a relationship that has some abusive dynamics, what should we do as parents to, what should our next steps be?
Yeah, I think, you know, first and foremost, like being prepared is simply being prepared to listen. I think a lot of parents think like, well, I'm not equipped with advice or the best thing to say. And what if I say the wrong thing? When anyone of any age, they just want to be heard. So your job is just to sit back, ask questions, tell me more, help me understand, repeat back what you're hearing. And that is the most important thing you can do for your child, to help them feel okay, understood, and not alone. So don't worry about knowing what to say. And you can even tell your child, okay, I don't have advice just yet, but we're going to work on this together and I'm going to come back to you. I think if there's, you know, inherent and imminent concerns, you know, there are, you can call the police, you can report something that happened, an incident, especially if there's physical harm. Otherwise, you know, I would say talk to the school about their resources. Many have social workers and trained specialists that work with teens who have gone through something traumatic. And schools often, I mean, schools are required to respond to disclosures too. So they might be able to work with separating the two parties if the two break up, making sure they don't have the same classes or lunch periods. So I think it's really just, let me talk to the school if necessary and see what they can do, see what supports they can provide to my child. And if not, there's always a local agency that provides free resources and support, free counseling to survivors. Or there's even just simple hotlines that you can call and gather information as a starting point. But I think, you know, take it seriously. If something is wrong or dangerous or unsafe, say that to your child, explain what you need to do, and go ahead and do it.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Throughout this entire conversation, I've had this thought that has continued to come up over and over and over. And that is that in order for us to be able to help our teens set themselves up to be in healthy long-term relationships, we also as parents need to know what that looks like. We need to also be in healthy relationships. We need to also be modeling to them what healthy boundaries look like. We need to be also not making underhanded comments at them in order to make them do their chores. We need to also be not minimizing what they are going through to show them that their emotional experiences are important and valid. And I think that, you know, a lot of this is just a theory, but I think that a lot of what happens in our own relationships is modeled by what we learn from the adults that we are closest to in our lives. And so, you know, my invitation, if you are listening to this and you're having little kind of nudges or your eyebrow is going up and you're maybe noticing some of these behaviors in your own adult relationship, is that we're not going to, our kids are not going to take us seriously as being somebody who can be there to support them in developing a healthy relationship if we are, first of all, not treating them in a way that makes them feel respected and safe and heard, and also not making sure that we are in relationships that are, that we're feeling respected and safe and heard, and so on and so forth. So, you know, there's, it's one thing to kind of want to separate this out and say, and not to say it's not important, because obviously we need to do this for our teens. And also there's like a bigger picture view of this, of we need to do this for ourselves as parents so that we can be actually equipped and actually have a healthy model for our kids to learn from, because kids do what we do. They don't do what we say.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the primary source of, you know, understanding and learning relationships is what we see in the home first. And then, of course, everything else on TV and TikTok and social media and movies. But, you know, children do model what they see in the home. And you're right that if you do have healthy relationships, you possess the language to know how to teach that and pass that information down. If you set good boundaries, it's much easier for you to show your child how to do the same. So assessing your own relationships is just as important as, you know, making sure you're just being a guide for your child's.
Mm-hmm. Ashley, this has been very enlightening for very many reasons. Is there anything else that you would like to share with us that would be important for us to know moving forward as people raising our next generation of humans?
Yeah, I think we just need to talk about this issue more. You know, I mean, the term domestic violence, dating violence, it's grisly and ugly. And we think of the worst case scenario stuff that we see on the movies and in TV. But, you know, even if we have to just use the word toxic relationships to really highlight these behaviors, it's important to say that's not normal. You don't have to share your location if you don't want to. You don't have to, you know, let them show up unannounced if you want private time. You know, I think we need to have these conversations. And I think really, you know, it's hard to sometimes express what healthy is, but I do think those two words that I mentioned up top, like, do you feel safe? Do you feel supported? They kind of encompass a lot of things. So, you know, I tell teens, keep asking yourself that. Ask yourself that on month one. If it's a yes and a yes, great. If month three, it's a no and a yes or two no's, sometimes you have to find the courage to walk away. Because as you mentioned, these relationships impact our mental health, our sense of self. I mean, I often say in my speeches that, you know, after it was all over, I think even worse than realizing the trauma of abuse and what I'd gone through was realizing I had no idea who I was. And, you know, at 20, 21, I had to really figure out who Ashley was, because I got so used to just molding to other people. So having these conversations, reminding your child that they are who they are, they should be their authentic self, they shouldn't have to conform to please someone, that someone who really loves you for who you are and doesn't need you to change for them. These are just little, you know, messages that we have to constantly reinforce. And hopefully they grow up remembering those messages and they show up when they are about to date.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for the work that you're doing, for the message that you're spreading, for these conversations that you're having. This is just very, it's very beautiful and very healing what you're doing and how the way that you're supporting our kids and our parents. And I think it's just really fantastic. So thank you.
Thank you.
Ashley, if anyone listening would like to get a hold of you or follow you on social media or find out more about what it is that you do, what are the best places for us to be able to locate you?
Yeah, I think the easiest is just to Google my name. My website is ashleybendixson.com. I'm on most social media sites. So whether you email me or send me a message on Instagram, I'm very responsive. So just look me up. As far as I know, I'm the only Ashley Bendixson, so you should find me pretty easily. But yeah, I mean, I have resources. I'm here to answer questions. I know sometimes people have, you know, very personal and like unique situations and they want some guidance on it. And I'm always glad to help. So I do hope to hear from some of your community.
Thank you. We'll make sure we go ahead and link you up in the show notes. So if you are listening, go ahead and pop into the show notes and you'll be able to click onto Ashley's links. And thanks for listening. Thanks for sitting. I know some of this felt, it even felt uncomfortable for me, you know, as I had to wonder about these things and my stepson is 16 and I'm, you know, I have little, there's little things that are bubbling up in my mind about little hums that are coming up, but important even when it is uncomfortable. So thank you again, Ashley, for everything that you have shared with us today. It's been a real pleasure.
When you're chasing after what matters, your heart knows where to go. If the moon gives up rising, the sun stops it shining, you know you'll have a hand to hold. As we wait on the time